Welcome to the Sagebrush Trail. Stories of the West, from the frontier to the Yukon. I'm Ordeh, reading Delilah of the Snows by Harold Bimhoff. Chapter 13. Esmond acquires information. Ingleby contrived to discover Colthurst camp, and when a police trooper, carrying a stout lariat, accompanied him back to the ravine, they had some little difficulty in transporting the major, who was no light weight, to the surface. It was, however, safely accomplished, and Ingleby was not greatly astonished to hear he had in the meanwhile insisted upon their spending at least that night in his commodious tent. Sewell possessed the useful faculty of making a good impression upon almost anybody, and generally exercised it even when it did not appear worthwhile. They spent the next day with the major, who extended them a bluff but cordial invitation to visit him at his official residence, which Ingleby, for reasons of his own, promised to do. He was not, however, a little astonished that Sewell, who had not his inducement, and could scarcely be expected to consider Major Colter's patronage any particular compliment, should evince an equal alacrity. Still, he did not feel warranted in inquiring his comrade's reasons, and promptly forgot all about it, when a few days later he and Ledger bottomed upon gold. It was not a rich find. Indeed, they laboriously transported and washed down a good many hundredweights of debris in return for an insignificant quantity of the precious metal. But it was sufficient to fill Ingleby with fresh ardor, and he lengthened his hours of toil until it was, with difficulty, he dragged himself back at night to the camp on the hillside. Every stroke of pick and drill brought him so much nearer the realization of his aspirations. Ledger protested now and then, but Hetty, who was wiser, said nothing, though there were times when she watched Ingleby, who naturally never suspected it, with anxious eyes. The physical strain and tension were commencing to tell on him, for even the experienced placer miner seldom knows whether the next few strokes of the shovel will bring him wealth or make it evident that he has thrown his toil away. There, however, came an evening when Ingleby desisted early in order to redeem his promise to Colthurst. And when he had made what he felt was a very insufficient toilet, Sewell, who had pegged out a claim in the vicinity, arrived at the bakery. Hetty and Ledger were sitting as usual at that hour beside the fire, and there was a little twinkle in the latter's eyes as he glanced at Sewell. "I suppose," he said, "Major Colthurst knows whom he is to have the pleasure of entertaining." Sewell laughed. "I felt it my duty to inform him, but my name did not seem to convey very much to him. In fact, I don't mind admitting that one could have fancied he had never heard of it. Then, having a certain sense of fitness, I endeavored to make him understand what my views were. They didn't appear to affect him greatly, either. He was good enough to predict that I would probably grow out of them." "He hasn't told you all," Ingleby broke in. "Major Colthurst graciously admitted that most men are occasionally afflicted with fancies of the kind when they are young. No sensible person minded it. He had even indulged in them himself when his colonel had been unduly hard on him, and he seemed quite under the impression that people generally took to our opinions by way of protest when they fancied themselves badly used." For a moment it almost seemed to Ingleby that Sewell's face hardened, and he remembered that his comrade had appeared faintly disconcerted when the major expressed this view in camp. It had naturally not occurred to Ingleby that Major Colthurst's deductions, like those of other men with no great appearance of intelligence, might come near the truth now and then. Hetty, who was looking at Sewell, did not, however, appear to notice anything unusual. "So you told him who you really were?" she asked. Sewell, for no very evident reason, stooped and flicked a little dust off one of his boots, and it was a few moments later when he looked up with a smile. "I think you heard me mention it," he said. "You're ready, Ingleby?" Ingleby stood up with a somewhat rueful glance, not altogether unwarranted, at his attire. He did not know what Hetty meant and felt no great interest in the question, for he had a supreme faith in one man and one woman, and if he had discovered that Sewell had been charged with felony, it would not have concerned him greatly. He would have believed in him, almost in spite of the evidences of his senses. Colthurst received them cordially when they reached his little log-built dwelling, which stood not far from the police outpost, beyond the canyon where a tremendous wall of hillside shut in the adjacent valley. That region, while unpleasantly remote from civilization, was still accessible, and the gold commissioner's quarters were, considering their situation, far from uncomfortable. There was even a very artistic set of chessmen, at which Colthurst glanced during a pause in the conversation. "I was once in a native Indian state, and those pieces are a little memento," he said. "They played the game rather well there, and I've had a liking for it ever since." Now, Ingleby's father had also played chess well, and he knew a little of the game, but he was accustomed to yield his comrade priority, and was more than usually content to do so that evening. Sewell, who seemed to understand this, smiled. "I'm afraid I should make a very indifferent opponent, sir, but that is your affair," he said. Colthurst drew out a little table with some alacrity, and Grace and Ingleby found a place apart from them. The latter made no great attempt at conversation, for he was worn out by a long day's toil and quite content to be there and listen to his companion. Ingleby could talk when he felt prompted to, but like other men with a capacity for strenuous effort, he could be silent without embarrassing himself or those about him. In the meanwhile, the surroundings had their effect on him. The soft light of the big shaded lamp was pleasant after the glare of the crackling fire. The hangings that hid door and windows conveyed to one who had lived as he had done a suggestion of comfort and luxury, and his eyes did not miss the fashion in which each trifle, brought up through long leagues of forest on the pack saddle, had been arranged. Grace Colthurst had artistic tastes, and she had also, to some extent, the means of indulging them. It was, however, her propinquity that most affected him. Her daintiness appealed to his senses, and the faint perfume that hung about her, and the touch of her gown when it brushed against him, sent a little thrill through him. Miss Colthurst was possibly not unaware of this, but she was nonetheless gracious to him. Ingleby was a well-favored man in physical effort and endurance, with a wholesome signalness of a purpose, had set a stamp upon him that almost amounted to distinction. Athletic toil and plain living, with the moral discipline which binds the worn-out flesh and obedience to the will, have a refining influence on most men, and there was in Ingleby's gaunt face, steady eyes, and clear bronze skin, the faint suggestion of spirituality, which in that country at least not infrequently characterizes even the placer minor of low degree. Grace Colthurst, who had quick perceptions, recognized it, but naturally kept her impressions to herself. "Mr. Sewell plays chess very well," she said. "In fact, he made what seemed to me a really brilliant opening." "He is one of the men who do everything that is worthwhile well," said Ingleby. "That sounds a little comprehensive, but I almost think it's no more than the fact." Grace asked no very pertinent question that Ingleby could remember, but nevertheless induced him to speak of his comrade, which, being simple of mind in some respects, he had evident pleasure in doing. In the meanwhile, she watched the man at the chess table, and it seemed to her that part at least of his friend's belief in him was justified. Sewell's face was expressive and mobile, as well as forceful, and there was a subtle suggestive gracefulness in his speech and gesture, which was not to be found in Ingleby's. Then she smiled and changed the subject. "I wonder," she said, "why he sacrificed the castle." "The knight," said Ingleby gravely, "was certainly not a very good exchange." Grace laughed. "I scarcely think he would ever, as they say in this country, go back on a friend. My father, as he said, is fond of the game, but that doesn't go very far after all. He plays it creditably. And Mr. Sewell, as you are quite aware, plays it exceptionally well. I wonder if he realizes that the major is not fond of losing." Ingleby smiled as he again glanced around the room. Then he turned to her, the origin and complement of its refinement, and she read his thoughts without difficulty. "I scarcely think that anybody who knows how we live would blame him," he said. Grace laughed. Then she said, "As I'm not quite sure that I know, suppose you tell me." Ingleby did so in simple fashion. And it is probable that most young women would not have found his story entertaining. Grace Colthurst, who had lived in the bush, however, had comprehension, and could fill in a good deal that he did not supply. It was also, in its own way, to one who knew that country, an epic, a recital of man's high endeavor and Herculean grapple with untrammeled nature. For in the struggle for the subjugation of the wilderness, the placer miner leads the van. The smothering rush of slipping gravel, the crash of shattered props as the little shaft closed up, and the unexpected fall of half-charred trees had a place in it, as well as the monotony of toil. And the girl listened gravely. "And you have found the gold," she said. "A little," said Ingleby, "but not half enough. We have failed to bottom quite on the old creek bed, and are going to sink again or driving at it." The mention of insufficiency was in itself significant, for though he had spoken no word in Canada that could afford the slightest hint at the aspirations that had animated him, Grace was quite aware of them. There are not many women who do not know when a man is in love with them. "But there are only two of you, and it will take you ever so long," she said. "Still, we will get it done," and there was a curious brightness in Ingleby's eyes. Grace noticed the hollowness of his quiet face and the leanness of his hard, scarred hands, and her heart grew soft towards him. The sign of the strain was plain upon him, though the breaking point had not yet been reached, and it was for her that he had done so much. "And you expect the effort will be warranted," she said. Ingleby turned and looked at her gravely. "Men get rich, placer mining now and then, and it might happen to me," he said. "In fact, I almost think from what one or two of the old prospectors tell me that I am going to be successful. I don't know if you will understand me, but after a life like mine, the probability of being so is a little overwhelming." There was a tension in his voice, which had its effect upon the girl, and she sat silent for a moment or two, until the major's voice broke sharply in on them.
"Jack, I fancied at one time the game was in your hands, but there's seldom much use in anticipating when there are points you can't foresee," he said.
Grace glanced at Ingleby, who smiled. "I'm afraid Major Colthurst is right. One can only wait," he said. Just then there was a tapping at the door,
and Ingleby moved abruptly when Esmond came in. The officer, however, showed no sign of astonishment when he saw who was there, but smiled as he looked at Grace and turned to the major. "I have just come across for a few moments, and will not disturb you, sir," he said. "I don't suppose you have any objections to my looking over your register?"
"No," said Coldhurst, "it's yonder. Has anything gone wrong?"
Esmond's eyes rested for just a moment on Sewell.
"Only two or three of the men talking rather wildly, sir. Somebody has been putting notions into their heads. It occurred to me I might as well make sure they all had certificates."
"Quite right," said Coldhurst appreciatively. "I have decided objections to their doing me out of my money."
Esmond took down the register, which was not remarkably well kept, and had some little trouble in tracing out the information he desired. At last, however, he read, "Thomas Ledger, free miner certificate, $5, also $5, Walter Ingleby." He made a careful note of the date, and then turned over the pages systematically. Later on, he found Walter Ingleby, $5, but there was no further entry for Ledger. Then he put the book back, and the major glanced at him.
"Jack," he said, "I almost think I've got you, Mr. Sewell. You found what you wanted, Reggie?"
"Yes, sir," said Esmond, whose eyes now rested on Grace and Ingleby. "I fancy I have." He crossed the room in a leisurely fashion, and Ingleby rose when Grace turned to him. "You have, no doubt, come across Mr. Ingleby in the course of your duties, Reggie, but I should like to present him formally as one of my friends," she said. Esmond made Ingleby, who responded as briefly, a little curt inclination.
"I have," he said, "certainly met Mr. Ingleby at least twice already."
"I believe I remember one occasion," said Grace with a little twinkle in her eyes. She had naturally not heard of the second encounter. "I'm not sure you were in quite as good a temper as usual that night. Still, you see, circumstances are very different now."
Esmond laughed, but there was a dryness in his tone, which Ingleby afterwards remembered.
"Circumstances have a trick of changing somewhat rapidly in this country," he said. "You have, I believe, bottomed on gold, Mr. Ingleby?"
"Yes," said Ingleby.
"You struck it rich?"
"No," said Ingleby. "Still, the signs are promising. We hope to be more fortunate when we have driven our adit."
"How long do you expect to be over it?"
"It is a little difficult to tell." Esmond appeared to reflect, and Grace, who watched him, did not quite understand his face.
"Well," he said, "I suppose placer mining is always a trifle uncertain. One would almost fancy that baking was more profitable. Your friend Miss Ledger seems to be doing well, or is it your venture?"
Ingleby wondered if this was meant for Miss Colthurst's enlightenment, but he could not very well permit his dislike of the man who would seize such an opportunity to become apparent then, and there was also something in Esmond's tone which suggested that he might, after all, have a different purpose. Unfortunately, he had no notion of what that purpose was. "She is," he said quietly, "selling a good deal of bread."
"At excellent prices. Still, she probably deserves all she gains. It would cost a good deal to bring flour up. How did she get it?"
Ingleby was a little astonished at the man's persistence, and Grace noticed it.
"Are you going to turn baker too?" she asked.
Esmond laughed in a fashion which brought the blood to Ingleby's face. Still, he answered the man's question.
"I went down for it," he said. Just then the major's voice broke in again.
"A very good fight, Mr. Sewell. I scarcely think I could have beaten you if you hadn't let me see your game. However strong your position is, that is seldom very wise."
"Major Colthurst," said Esmond, "is now and then astonishingly accurate. One could generalize from such a speech as that, but to resume the topic, wasn't it a little careless of you, Ingleby? You invalidate your record when you leave a placer claim." Ingleby, secure, as he fancied, smiled. "Ledger," he said, "holds a share with me." "Of course," said Esmond, as though the subject had no longer any interest to him. "So you left Ledger. Well, I must get back to the outpost now. Grace, you will excuse me." He went out, and while Grace entertained Ingleby, the major and Sewell, who lost again, played another game. Then she made and served them coffee with her own hands, and Ingleby, at least, went back to his tent filled with the memory of how she did it. In the meanwhile, Grace, sitting by the fire when he had gone away, glanced at her father. "I wonder," she said, "what you think of Mr. Sewell?"
"The man," said Colthurst, "is, in spite of the opinions he seems to hold, evidently a gentleman. I can't think of a more appropriate word for it. And there is also, I fancy, a good deal more in him than anyone who is not good at reading character might suppose. He plays chess exceptionally well. In fact, almost as well as I do."
Grace smiled a little. "I fancied he did," she said. "Were you equally pleased with his companion?"
"Yes," said the major reflectively. "He strikes me as sensible and solid, and one has a fancy that there's often a screw loose somewhere about brilliant men. They are apt to double up unexpectedly when the strain comes. The other kind, I always find, are more likely to wear well."
Grace laughed, but made no observation. Major Colthurst, as she was quite aware, was almost painfully solid himself, but he had at least stood the rough usage of a hard world remarkably well, and she was disposed to admit the correctness of his opinion. Still, there was, in spite of his name, something about Sewell that Ingleby did not possess, which appealed to her. Join me next time on the Sagebrush Trail for more Western adventure in Delilah of the Snows by Harold Binlaws. Thank you.